Now, there are two parts to grace. The first part is grace that we think of that brings us into relationship with Christ or with God. Then there's grace that enables us to live the Christian life. Most of us have heard a lot about the first one, but not a lot about the second one. This series is going to really be centered in a lot about the second one. Now, think about the definitions that are running through your mind when you say the word grace. You've probably heard grace defined as unmerited favor. In other words, God's forgiveness that we don't deserve. Some have described it as us getting what we do not deserve. So that's sort of the part of grace that has to do with bringing us in relationship with God. There's a real interesting story. Maybe you've heard of C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He was a phenomenal orator and Christian thinker. He was once in a British conference with experts from all over the world. The conference was on comparative religions. And the experts were debating what really is Christianity's unique contribution to the world. What is unique about the Christian faith that other religions don't seem to have a parallel to? And they talked about incarnation. They talked about resurrection. But there are other faiths in the world, other religions in the world that have theologies that are similar to that. C.S. Lewis happened to walk in the room in the middle of this discussion, and when he found out what they were talking about, what is Christianity's unique? What's unique about the Christian faith that other faith doesn't have a parallel to? And he said, that's simple. Grace. It's very simple. Grace. There's no other religion in the world that has a grace theology. In Buddhism, there's the Eightfold Path. In Hinduism, there's karma. In the Muslim religion, there's the code of law. In other words, all of these are paths or works or ways to earn forgiveness. Only Christianity sees God's love as unconditional. In other words, there aren't rules that you have to follow in order to earn it. It cannot be earned by you. It cannot be earned by me. It's completely unique. Now, that all has to do and helps us understand with the first part of grace, which we probably know the most about. This series is going to center on the second part of grace, the part of grace that enables us to live the Christian life. Not just become a Christian, but to live Christian. Now, grace is one of my favorite subjects, because it seems too impossible and too simple to be true. I've spent the better part of my Christian life reminding myself that it really is true. Trying to wrap my brain around, trying to wrap my heart around, trying to understand. But the more time I spend with people, the more I realize I'm not alone. Many people have a hard time with grace. And I think we have a hard time with grace because our culture has made the word grace impossible to understand. Think about the slogans in our culture that reflect our philosophy of life. There's no free lunch. You get what you deserve. You want money? Work for it. You want love? Earn it. You want mercy? Show you deserve it. Do unto others before they do unto you. What's wrong with the world is most people want something for nothing. Give others what they deserve, but not one penny more. No pain, no gain. And you think about the slogans that sort of capture the philosophy of American life, and statements like these make me wonder if our culture hasn't bled into Christianity and made it an American form of spirituality. And we can begin to think about spiritual growth as a skill to be attained, like good handwriting or a good golf swing or a good baseball cut. When we mix our culture with the truth, we can begin to think about spirituality from a consumer's point of view. Now, sink your mind into this. Focus in on this thought. If we allow Christianity to be mixed with American philosophy and we think about it from a consumer's point of view, then Christianity becomes self-help. The problem with Christianity becoming self-help is when it becomes self-help, it's self-centered. And Christianity at its heart is not self-centered, it's God-centered. And when you switch that, you don't have Christianity, you have spirituality that may be void of its Christian roots. For us to ever understand grace, we have to begin with God, not with ourselves. But the brand of spirituality that's often sold in America today starts with you, the consumer. But Christianity doesn't start with us. It starts with who started it. It starts with God. Unfortunately, some of us were taught a similar philosophy in church. It was just kind of wrapped in spiritual language and emotion, so it had the ring of truth about it, but not the substance. Sometimes the church has presented us a faith that challenges us to do better and try harder and pray longer, and the solution to all our problems can be defined in one simple word: more. If you'll just pray more, give more, try harder, sacrifice more, have more faith, have more commitment, have more holiness, put your nose to the grindstone and make up your mind, you're going to serve God if it kills you, and usually it does. And we live out our guilt-ridden and inadequate love, trying to do better, but living in a hamster wheel of failure. Grace is too often misunderstood. We'll spend this series growing deeper in our understanding of grace. Sometimes I find that I can understand what something is by understanding what it's not. And so today this message is first going to focus on what grace is not. Jesus told a story that gives us, I think, the most revealing picture of what grace is not in Luke chapter 15. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus told the story of the prodigal son. Now, I think sometimes we misunderstand the stories in Scripture because we don't know why they're told. Let me tell you why he told the story. The reason he told the story was to make a point to the religious leaders who were called Pharisees. They were gossiping and complaining because Jesus was hanging out with people who were sinners. And in the minds of the Pharisees, anyone who rejected holiness deserved to be punished. Anyone who lived in sin deserved to be punished. And even if they were restored, or even after they were punished, they couldn't expect to be treated the same way as everyone else after the rebellion, as they had before. They really struggled with grace and forgiveness, and Jesus told the story to uncover their blindness. Now, the story went something like this. There was a man who had two sons. His sons were grown. The younger son decided that he wanted to shake the dust off his feet of the family farm, and he wanted to go out and spread his wings, so he demanded that his father give him his inheritance, even though tradition said that you didn't receive your inheritance till your father passed away. He wanted it now. So he got his inheritance. He went off to a foreign land. He wasted all his family's inheritance to him away. He wasted it in sinful living and loose living and wild living and partying. And he blew it all. And after he blew it all and he got really low and really depressed, he came to his senses and said, you know what? Even the people who my dad pays to work for him lives better than this. And so he decided to go back home. So he went back home, and when he returns, the dad's so overwhelmed with joy that his son's come to his senses and come back home that he meets him halfway down the road. He runs and meets him and hugs him and brings him inside. And he doesn't want his son to be a servant. He doesn't want him to be a hired hand. He wants his son to be a son. So he brings him back into the house, and he puts a robe on his back and a ring on his finger, which all signified that he belonged to the family and he was restored to the place he was before he left. And then he had a big party, had a big cookout. In the meantime, the older brother hears all the partying. He comes to see what's going on. He's so angered by what he sees that he won't even come back in the house. Now, Jesus is basically saying to the Pharisees, when you get mad at me for eating and welcoming sinners, you act like the older brother. You won't even come in the house. The older brother is often, in this story, gives us a clear picture of how grace is often misunderstood. In verse 29 of Luke 15, the older brother makes three statements that reveal, I think, not just his understanding or the Pharisees' understanding of grace, but I think if we happen to misunderstand grace anywhere in the world, at any time period, it generally comes through one of these thoughts. So let's look at those statements. If you got a pen, maybe you want to get your bulletin, something to write on. Maybe you're taking notes on your iPhone. Jot these thoughts down today. Verse 29 of Luke 15, the older son is protesting and he says, "All these years I've been slaving for you." In other words, he's back, you're partying, I never left, I didn't do anything wrong, and all these years I've been here at the house slaving for you, working for you, working my fingers to the bone for you. And in that statement is revealed one of the great misunderstandings about grace. If you're taking notes, here it is. Number one, grace is not about what you do. Grace is not about what you do. He began to complain in a melodramatic way. All these years I've slaved away. He was living under the impression that doing good things for his father was the key to pleasing his father. And those people who believe that good works are the key to pleasing God will keep careful records of their service, and they will use their service to gain leverage in bargaining with God in some desired blessing. Now let's just get this straight from the beginning. Everyone who believes, and every one of us at any time in our life, when we are tempted to fall into the ditch of belief that doing good things for God is the key to pleasing God, when we believe that, we're not really serving God, we're really serving ourselves. Let me show you how this works. People who believe that may appear to be faithful and may appear to be humble, and in most churches, they're the people that get the most pats on the back. But the deep truth is, there's a misunderstanding of grace. They think that doing good things for God, then they will please God, and more, and the harder I work, the more I serve, the more faithful I am, the more humble I am, the more I please God, and therefore the guilt will lift off of my life. Or the blessing that I'm seeking will come. And what their philosophy is, most of the time, unconscious. Because it comes from our own flesh and it comes from our own wrong religious teaching. We think that by those good works, by that faithfulness, by that humility, we will corner God. We will corner Him, paint Him in a corner with our own good works, and He'll have no choice but to bless us and do something good for us. I can remember when Stacy and I were youth pastoring in our very first church back in the early 90s. It was a very charismatic, you know, it was very intense. And I can remember in the worship service sitting one day, standing and worshiping, and there was this guy that sat right on the front, and there was a point right when the music would hit its most climactic point. He would come down as close as he'd get to the steps, he would get on his knees, and he'd lift his hands straight up in the air. And I saw it, and I thought, wow, he's really worshiping. And then the next service he did it again. And then the next service he did it again. And the next week he did it again. 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 And he kept doing it over and over and over. And finally I thought in my head, would you just not judge me if I tell you this? Finally I thought in my head, come on, guy. I mean, is every week of your life really like that? That melodramatic, that there's such a display, there's such a drama, there's such an expression that I thought, man, that's, I understand there are moments in life we are moved and we just respond the best way we know how. I thought, man, this is a deep pattern. What is this for? And I can remember the Holy Spirit speaking to my heart and saying, the reason that He does this is because He thinks that I'll love Him more if He does it. So don't judge him. Pray for him. Pray for him that he'll understand my love. And I remember after that standing there thinking, in services, watching, thinking, God, sometimes I'd go down with him. I'd say, God, please, please, let freedom come from a need to perform with the belief that somehow, in this sense of the melodramatic, that I've earned God's favor or become more pleasing to Him. I'm not saying outward signs of demonstration are always that. They're not. Sometimes they're freedom. But sometimes they're bondage. And only God knows. I don't know. And only God knows the heart. God didn't create us for service. He created us for fellowship. Serving is a matter of identity, not a matter of activity. From deep fellowship with Christ, our heart overflows into service. So the first way that this older brother misunderstood is he thought by serving God, by performing for God, by doing great things for God, that he would conjure up God's favor and God's love. He would somehow receive God's grace that way. Here's the second statement. Verse 29. He said, not only have I stayed here and slaved for you, I never disobeyed your orders. What's he saying? Like him. I never disobeyed your orders. Here's the second thought. First, grace is not about what you do. Second, grace is not about what you do not do. Grace is not about what you do not do. He assumed that pleasing the Father was a matter of keeping the rules. The problem is, he kept all the rules, but he missed the party. He stayed out in the yard with his arms folded, probably with a toothpick and his teeth clamped down on it. The Pharisees were like the LeBron James of keeping rules. They specialized in it. And they had decided that all of life boiled down to a slide rule chart, and there was nothing fun about it, and they weren't going to let anybody else have any fun either. If you didn't live up to their expectations, then you would be punished by criticism and rejection. The truth is, there's people in this room, you grew up with parents like that. If you didn't walk the chalk, if you didn't follow the rules, if you didn't make mom and dad happy, you would be punished with criticism and rejection. It's called conditional love. These are the conditions by which I will love you. In other words, if you do the right thing, I will reward you with love. If you do the wrong thing, I will punish you by withholding love. To a religious, legalistic, or controlling person, love is a reward. To a grace-filled person, love is a given. It doesn't have to be earned. It doesn't have to be deserved. It's given because of relationship, whether the rules are kept or not. It's a uniquely Christian doctrine. It's called unconditional love. There is no religion in the world that offers it. And there is a reason. Because every religion in the world is man-made. This one is God-made. And it's different. C.S. Lewis was right. Grace is the difference. Now here's the third statement. It says, I've slaved for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. And then verse 29, the rest of the verse, he says, you never gave me even a young goat to celebrate with my friends. Grace is not about what you do. Grace is not about what you do not do. And thirdly, grace is not about fairness. Grace is not about fairness. The older brother was a religious man. He was blind and miserable, living with a definite, unsatisfied desire. He always wanted to have a cookout. That was his hidden dream that he never told anybody. If he went on a talk show and they said, what's your wildest dream? He'd say, I want a cookout. I want a barbecue. And it seems his life was devoid of joy because he couldn't have his goat and eat it too. The father seemed shocked by that response. And he said, look at all the goats on our farm. There are thousands. They all belong to you. Everything that I have is yours. In a strange way, he was as blind as the younger son who left and spent all of his inheritance. Neither one of the sons understood what they had in the father's house. One left and didn't understand what he had. One stayed and didn't understand what he had. The moral of the story is that the sinner is better off than the saint because he understood grace. The blindness of rebellion and the blindness of religion will produce the same joyless, broken life. If you have trouble in your own joy level, check your grace. If you're struggling with joy, check your grace level. In the end, the older brother was angry, not because he was wrong. Listen, he wasn't wrong, but because he had done everything right and thought that he would get more for it. He thought, I have slaved here. I have been faithful. I have never disobeyed. I have never wasted my dad's inheritance, and he's going to get a party and I'm not. What's he saying? You're celebrating him? He doesn't deserve it. I deserve it. Wow. Have you ever felt that way? You don't have to raise your hand. It's rhetorical. Have you ever felt that way? Now look, pull the mask off for a minute and be honest with yourself. When something bad comes into your life, have you ever asked yourself, at least in your own mind, what did I do to deserve this? Have you ever felt that way when you see someone excel in life seemingly unscathed with not even a tenth of the challenges that you have? Everything seems to come easy for them and you say, why doesn't anything like that ever happen to me? You ever felt that way? After Jesus' resurrection, he tied up a lot of loose ends before he went to heaven. One of them was the Apostle Peter. The Apostle Peter had denied that he knew Jesus. He had abandoned him, and he'd even went back to his old life. Jesus restored their relationship over breakfast on the side of the seashore. And he restored him to ministry. Near the end of that meal, this is part of the story that you rarely ever hear when that passage is taught out of. Near the end of the meal, Jesus told the Apostle Peter that he would die a painful and a terrible death. Church history records that the Apostle Peter was crucified to death. At that moment, John, one of the disciples closest to Jesus, caught the Apostle Peter's eye, and he said, "What about him?" In other words, I'm going to die. I mean, I just denied you, and I went back to my old life, and then I come back here to breakfast, and we get through this whole dialogue about, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? Do you really love me? Do you really love me? And you're talking to me about love, and then just after that, you tell me I'm going to die a terrible and painful life. What about John? What's going to happen to him? I mean, he deserves it as much as I do. I mean, at least I stood up for you. At least I cut the soldier's ear off. I mean, at least I tried. I mean, I got the confession right. You are on this rock. I will build my church. That's me. I'm the guy. Right? What about him? Listen to Jesus' answer. Jesus doesn't answer every question, but he did answer this one. John 21, verse 22, he said, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you?" What is that to you? You must follow me. What is that to you? What business of yours is that? What does that have to do with God's plan for your life? What does that have to do with what God's doing in your life? What does that have to do with anything? Have you ever had that question? What about him? What about her? Why do we have this struggle and they don't? Look, I have a 15-year-old son and an 11-year-old son. Both are type 1 diabetics. I could easily ask that question. God, why couldn't we at least have one? Why two? Why do we spend every hour of every day and every hour of every night in hand-to-hand combat just trying to help our children live a normal life? Why? Why does that happen to us? What did we do? I mean, from my youth, Lord, I responded the best way I knew how. I left the brokenness of my life. I've answered your call. I've been faithful best I know how. I haven't been perfect, but I've been okay. Why did you let this happen to us? Why both? All of this kind of thinking is a misunderstanding of grace. Grace doesn't give us equal experiences. It guarantees us that no matter what our experience is, God loves us equally and His love is unconditional. Therefore, it does not matter what happens to you. His love will not change. Thank God. Thank God. No matter how bad life is to you, God won't stop loving you and He won't reject you. Thank God. Thank God. There are no bigger people and littler people in the kingdom. There is just people that receive God's grace. Can you imagine what just happened? The Apostle Peter says, yes, Lord, I love you, but what about him? He's still wondering. Listen to what's still going on in his mind. He's still wondering, what will all this loving of God do for him? And the thing it does for us most is it sets us free from trying to manipulate God to do what we want. In its final work, it causes us to live a God-centered Christian life, not a self-centered Christian life. In the end, the Apostle Peter got it. He got it. He didn't get it that day, but he got it. Church history records, not only was the Apostle Peter crucified, but at his own request, he was crucified upside down. Because the Apostle Peter said, I'm not worthy to be crucified the same way Jesus was. Flip the cross upside down for me. Now wait a minute. Why does that tell us he got it? Because at the end, he wasn't saying, after all I've done for you, I slave for you, I obey you, I follow you, after all I've done, I've been faithful, I didn't disobey, I don't deserve this. At the end, you find him filled with grace saying, what I don't deserve is to die the same way Jesus did. Flip the cross over. He got it. Boy, did he get it. And it changed his life. I want you to take a statement home with you today. Here it is. God's love is enough. God's love is enough. Enough for what? Enough for anything. God's love is enough. It was powerful enough that it empowered the Apostle Peter not to try to manipulate God to get what he wanted. It was powerful enough not to let him point his finger at John and say, what's going to happen to him? It was powerful enough for him to say, God, this is the life you've given me, and by the power of grace, I embrace it. They didn't have to chase him down to find him. He said, flip the cross over. Grace gave him power to live the life he had in an extraordinary way. I'm going to ask our worship team to come now. Who can really say that anyone has lived a better life than anyone else? God's grace is here to empower you. Listen to this. To live your life at an extraordinary level. I've heard teaching on grace that connects itself to superstars and then says, this person was empowered by grace. What about the people's names that you don't know? What about the people that'll die on the mission field in some obscure dark corner of the world, locked into a prison because they preach the gospel, and we'll never hear of them till we get to heaven? I say they lived an extraordinary life because of God's grace. You can't tell by someone's accomplishment how extraordinary their life was. You can't tell by someone's record how extraordinary someone's life was. But this series is about God's grace to live the life you have, not to compare it to someone else's. Grace is not about fairness. not about competition. It's not about who did the best. Grace gave the Apostle Peter the power he needed to live his life in an extraordinary way. Grace is God's love in action. A prayer came to me several months ago. And we'll pray it today. I was just struggling in my own life as I was walking and praying. This thought, and I just believe that God put the thought in my head. I just began to pray, God, convince me that you love me and I'll be okay. Convince me and keep me convinced. And I guess really everything else I'm praying about doesn't matter. God, convince me and keep me convinced that you love me. God's love is enough. It's enough. Grace is God's love in action. Would you stand with me this morning?